We all have questions about cancer. You know, are there particular ways of eating or living that might prevent cancer? Are there types of diets that might help in the treatment of cancer? These are all very important questions. They're valid questions. And I've got a wonderful guest today, the author of BioDiet, Dr. David Harper, a PhD researcher who's been doing a lot of cancer research. And I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation. If you know anyone who has a family history of cancer or who's worried about cancer, who has cancer, please consider sharing this video with them. It could absolutely affect the trajectory of their life. So let's bring on Dr. Harper. Doc, welcome. It's so glad to have you.
Great. Wonderful to be here, Ken. Finally, we got this arranged. We've been talking since April, so I'm glad to be here today. Yeah.
We've been trying to make this happen for you guys since April, and mostly my fault, partly Harper's fault, but mainly I'll tell you, it's my grievous fault, okay? So I forgive you. Thanks so much for doing this. I know that you've been active in cancer research for years, and so many people have so many questions. Is this diet going to cause cancer? Is this diet going to prevent cancer? And so I'd really like to dig into all of that and more. Wherever this conversation leads us, I'm happy to go. First, tell us who you are. Just a brief little snippet about yourself. Why should we care about your opinion on this topic, this very important topic?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, I'm a university professor, a lifelong teacher, 40 years now teaching health at university levels. So anatomy, physiology, pathology, nutrition, contemporary health issues. I've also been working for several years now in collaboration with the BC Cancer Research Center, which is one of the leading cancer research centers in the world, with one of my colleagues there, Dr. Terry Crystal, who's one of the world leaders on low-carb diets and the effects on cancer. And then we've collaborated for the last few years with a fellow I'm sure you know, Dr. Jeff Volek at The Ohio State University on a three-year study to investigate the therapeutic benefits of ketogenic diets, specifically for women with metastatic breast cancer, so very late-stage breast cancer. And I have to say, you know, I'm really just the communicator of the amazing work that these teams are doing. Yes, I would say I'm a cancer researcher, but I'm really a health educator. So I'm more involved with the good work that you're doing is getting this information through to the general public, because when it goes through those filters, of academia and journals and the media and so on, it often gets filtered out. And there are competing interests there, which we both know about. I know you've talked about on your show many times.
Yes.
So I'm just trying to talk directly to individuals and try and teach them that, yes, the most important lifestyle decision you make every day, Dr. Barry, is what goes into your mouth, what's on the end of your fork. There's a study that came out, I think it was 2017, it was a global study of the burden of chronic disease. So what causes chronic disease? So they looked at, lack of exercise, sedentary behavior, smoking, alcohol, and it turns out that diet is more important than all of those combined in terms of whether or not you're going to experience chronic disease. And I'm sure your listeners know chronic disease are things like cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, so on, not acute diseases like COVID or, trauma like injuries. So these are the things that haunt us later on in life. And I would say if there's one message I want to get through to people, again, the most important decision you're making is what's on the end of your fork.
Oh, I totally agree. I couldn't agree more. I think other lifestyle changes matter, but I really consider them to be in the 10%, right? If you want to fix 90% of the problem, it's the food you're putting in your face. That's going to fix 90% of the problem. Now, I want to ask you a question about something you mentioned in another lecture, but first of all, I want to ask everybody watching this. We got 864 watching. That's not nearly enough. Everybody right now, please click the share button and share this on your favorite social media, because millions of people around the world are suffering with cancer directly, but there are hundreds of millions who have family members who they're worried about, who need this information to know that, no, guess what? There's hope. There's hope. This is not a completely lost cause. You can make changes in your diet starting today. Mm-hmm. Today, that will absolutely affect the trajectory of your future health, your future cancer risk. And if you've already been diagnosed with cancer, your future life with or without cancer. So please share this video. There's way more people out there who need to hear this message. Doc, I heard you talk about some research that was done on the First Nations people and, yeah, and the diet that they ate and how often they contracted cancer. Could you briefly just go over that and tell people about this?
Yeah, well, it wasn't work done by me, but colleagues that I know, Dr. Richard Mathias, who actually introduced me to this notion many years ago, more than 10 years ago, spent his career looking at this. There have been many investigations of Inuit living in the far north. I'm in Canada here in Vancouver. We're talking about way far north. And of course, on their diet, you know, there's no pizzas and muffins up in the north, especially on their traditional diet. They're eating 90%, 70 to 90%, closer to 90% saturated fat, which according to, you know, the standard American diet that's recommended by dietitians, that's supposed to kill you, give you heart disease and so on. Well, it turns out on their traditional diet, no cardiovascular disease, no diabetes, a single case of cancer would be worth writing a paper on, because on their traditional diet, and this includes the First Nations in my area on the west coast of BC, where they eat a lot of salmon and so on, but it's mostly animal product, high in saturated fat, very low in carbohydrate, therefore very likely ketogenic. And on that diet, they experience almost no chronic disease. And they do live, you know, if they can avoid injuries or accidents, very long lives, typically into their 90s and so on. And I love the way you talk about a proper human diet, Dr. Barry, because I would call it a natural human diet. You know, when we were hunting and gathering, again, there's no pizzas and cornflakes out there. We were eating fish, whatever animals we could catch. We'd eat the organ meats first. On that diet, you see a very low incidence of chronic disease in populations that eat that sort of a diet. And I should mention, you know, we're talking about cancer today. The same, I view all those things as the same thing. Yep. When you have cancer, you have diabetes, or you have cardiovascular disease, you have metabolic disease.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
You have metabolic disease that's right at the mitochondrial level. So when we talk about metabolism, people often think of, you know, calories in, calories out. And when we talk about metabolism, and you and I are both have a background as animal physiologists, so we have that understanding of the cellular molecular biology. Metabolism is the sum total of all the chemical reactions in your body. So you can, through lifestyle, push those towards very positive outcomes. In other words, health-promoting chemical reactions. Or if you adopt poor strategies, you know, you eat a poor diet in particular, you're going to push that metabolism towards chronic disease. So I view cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, even Alzheimer's as different manifestations of the same root cause metabolic disorder. And the easiest way to fix that is through diet. And the first thing you should do, I'm sure you'd agree, Dr. Barry, is get sugar out of your diet.
Absolutely. And what Dr. Harper was alluding to, I threw up a graphic here to help you guys see this. There's nothing really magic in a ketogenic diet, in a very, very low carbohydrate diet. And so a lot of people get confused by this. They're like, well, how can keto, because there's definitive research now showing that for diabetes, for cardiovascular risk, for weight reduction, for epilepsy, it is the diet of choice. This is not even a debatable any longer in science. There's so much research that backs that up. But even for other diseases like acne, neurological diseases, PCOS, and cancer, and we're going to talk about the cancer research coming up, there's more and more research not only being done currently, there's hundreds of studies, but there's already cancer research on the books showing very clearly that a ketogenic diet almost certainly prevents cancer, but absolutely can be used as an adjunct therapy for cancer when someone's already been diagnosed. Now, I want everybody watching this. We got over 1,000 now. Tell me where you're watching from. What city, what state, what country? Where are you watching this from? I want to see it in the comments. So you want any comments on this graphic, Doctor? You already pretty much laid it out.
Yeah, well, I'd say it's already 10 years old. So we've moved on from there. Again, the black area is the strong evidence where there are therapeutic benefits for ketogenic diet on the right side. Somebody in the comments mentioned PCOS. Absolutely. That's polycystic ovarian syndrome. The leading cause of infertility in women is due to insulin resistance, and a ketogenic diet will help to reverse that. Maybe later we can talk about my axis of illness, which are the three things that contribute to these chronic diseases. So in terms of cancer, one thing I want to get through to folks is you very politely refer to me as doctor. That's a PhD, not an MD. I'm not a physician, and I'm not trying to say that a ketogenic diet will cure cancer. We actually can't say that. Right. I'm not even saying that a ketogenic diet can prevent cancer, because in order to say that as a scientist, we'd have to get tens of thousands of people, lock them away, feed them one diet or the other, wait 30 years and see what happens. Yep. And we don't have enough money on the planet to do that. Our study is very small, just a dozen or so women in the experimental side over 12 weeks and then 6 months and a year. And that's almost $1 million. So we're not going to do that. So what we do look at is, can a ketogenic diet be used, as you mentioned, as an adjunct therapy? Will it help improve cancer outcomes? And that's the work we're doing on at the Ohio State University. It should be published this year. I don't want to, give the end story away, but the results are very positive. And there are other studies that have shown quite clearly that there is a therapeutic benefit to a ketogenic diet as an adjunct therapy. So then the theory is, if we can use a ketogenic diet to treat diabetes, which we've done very effectively, if we can use ketogenic diets to treat cancer or to treat PCOS, then it also follows logically that it would be helpful in preventing it if you adopted it before you're sick.
Absolutely.
And as you and I would agree, we don't really have a healthcare system in the West. We have a disease management system.
Absolutely.
We wait till it's broken, and then we throw all kinds of very expensive technology at it to try and fix it, and we're very good at that. But it's way cheaper and way better to prevent it from happening in the first place, right? So that's what we really need to focus on, is how can we prevent it? So again, scientifically, we can't conclude it. I don't have 30 years to wait.
Right.
I know for my own.
The people that watch my videos, they're well aware of the strength of different types of research, and they realize that observational studies don't really prove anything at all, and that in order to do a randomized controlled trial in humans, it would take 30 years. Just like you said, we'd have to lock, 1,000 people in a room and give them junk, and another 1,000 people in a room and give them keto, and then wait 30 years. And that's just not a doable diet. But you alluded earlier to sugar as the first thing to get out of your diet. So let me pull up this graphic from a talk you did recently. So I made a video about 5 years ago. God, I'm getting old. 5 years ago, and the title was Cancer Loves Sugar. And I went into detail how this is pretty commonly known in biology and medicine. And I even talked about the PET scan and how we use PET scans and how PET scans actually find cancer. So tell us about this, and then I got some questions for you.
Sure. Well, this is a slide actually from my colleague at University of Alberta, Dave Wiesenhunt, who loaned it to me. And it shows how they use something called fluorodeoxyglucose, which is a radioactive form of glucose, to image tumors. So they inject this, and you can see in the armpit in this woman, that little black spot, that's where they inject it. And then the glucose goes, and it concentrates where cells are absorbing it at the highest rate. And cancer cells can't now, I shouldn't say this so broadly. Most cancer cells cannot absorb and use glucose aerobically, like the rest of our muscle cells and heart cells and so on can. They will, in order to produce energy to continue to divide as cancer cells do, they need an energy source. And so they use glucose exclusively. And in order to provide that much energy, because it's an inefficient way when they burn it anaerobically, it's called the Vorberg effect, and Otto Vorberg won the Nobel Prize for this discovery, it concentrates 100 or 200 times in cancer cells. So we actually use it for imaging. So when you think about that, if we're using cancer cells for imaging, and it's the glucose that those cancer cells are taking up, why would we want a cancer patient to be eating a high carbohydrate diet, which is the recommended, you know, standard American diet, if that's what the cancer cells are looking to eat, right? So the other thing that happens, of course, when you eat a high carbohydrate diet, you release a lot of that carbohydrate as glucose in your blood. How does the body respond? By releasing insulin. And we know insulin helps get that glucose out of the blood, but insulin is one of the most powerful growth promoters in your body. It's a very powerful hormone. So when you have too much sugar in your blood and then too much insulin to try and take that sugar level down, you're giving the cancer cells all of the fuel and all of the fertilizer it needs for optimal growth. So that's why when we're talking about diet, eating a standard American diet when you have cancer, to me, just seems to be completely counterproductive. What you should do is reduce that glucose load as close to zero as you can get it. Let your body create its own glucose as needed, as libitum, as you say in medicine. And then that will moderate the insulin levels. And that gives your immune system a chance to identify and destroy those cancer cells.
Absolutely. And now I get a lot of kickback, mainly on Twitter, about the concept that cancer loves sugar. You say very clearly, you know, it uses 100 times to 200 times more glucose than just normal somatic cells in the human body. Then I get people saying, well, there are some cancers that love fatty acids or love ketones or love oxalates or love fat. To your knowledge, looking over the cancer literature like you do, has anybody found a cancer cell line that can thrive and metastasize on fat or ketones or oxalates in the absence of glucose?
I'm no expert on this, but my short answer is yes, there are. There about 60 to 70% of cancers that we know, we're talking only about solid tumors here, not like right. blood cancers and lymphomas and so on. There are some types of cancer where those cells can use other metabolites other than glucose. That's true. And there are almost surely through their rapid adaptation and ability for cancer cells, if deprived from glucose, to modify to use those things to a limited degree. But it's always it's a balancing act. It's when you have a drug therapy or even radiation to destroy cancer cells, it's still up to your immune system to set you back on the right path. Your immune system has to be able to identify and destroy those cancer cells at the cell by cell by cell level. And so what we're doing with a ketogenic diet is we're tipping that balance in favor of your immune system by reducing the load and the growth promoting effects of that high carbohydrate diet. So as I say, it's not by itself a cure for cancer, but we have shown, I think, conclusively in a number of different cancers that it's a very good adjunct therapy. And it's being used, I think, at about 30 or 40 different cancer research centers in the U.S. And this is just in the last 5-10 years. I mean, people are just catching on to how effective it is. So yep. if you're an oncologist and you have a patient and you realize that being on a ketogenic diet is going to prove the outcome of your patient, you're going to recommend that.
Yeah. That's a section of medicine where I'm seeing rapid adoption of a ketogenic yep. diet is oncologist. And once they realize, oh, holy crap, there's research to support this. There's research to show that the high sugar diet, the orange juice, the cookies, the treats that we give people literally after their chemo and radiation therapy, mm-hmm. that's probably not helping anything. But that's one of the areas of medicine I see very rapid adoption. H. Cooper said, sister-in-law in remission from stage 4 terminal breast cancer, third time getting cancer. She went low carb, low sugar per her doctor's orders. So here's an oncologist saying that. We got Carol. My husband was diagnosed in 19 with B-cell lymphoma. When we asked his oncologist at the get-go if sugar-fed cancer cells, he literally laughed at us and said no. He lost some of my respect at that moment. And rightfully so. What would you say to Carol?
Well, it's a lymphoma again, so that's not right. a solid tumor.
That's right. That's a different type of tumor. But to even imply that cancer doesn't in some way utilize sugar to thrive and to metastasize, well, it's arrogant at best and ignorant at worst.
And I have to say, Dr. Barry, this is why your show is so important, because when you went through medical school, how much nutrition education did you get in your med? Where did you go to medical school? I can't remember where
I went. I went to the University of Tennessee Health Science Center in Memphis.
Yep.
And I got one half of one semester of nutrition training in my second year of medical school. So I think we went maybe Tuesday and Thursday each week for a half a semester. And then the other half of the semester was behavioral science. So you can tell that my medical school really thought nutrition and behavioral science, the psychology, psychiatry was super, super important. We got a half a semester of training my second year of med school. But it's the vast majority of that nutrition training was, how do you feed someone who's has third degree burns and they're in the burn unit, or they're in the intensive care and unconscious? How do you start an IV and feed that person? That was probably 80% of our nutrition training, just the care and feeding of an average human in the wild. Very little training on that whatsoever. And that was the only training in the second year of med school. After that, nobody ever talked about nutrition again. It was just which drug to use.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty typical and probably even pretty good. And I think the average in North America is about 5 to 7 hours in medical school of nutrition. It's basically, these are carbohydrates, you know, fats, carbohydrates, proteins, and so on. So to answer your call-in question, physicians are not experts in nutrition. And this particular physician doesn't sound like they have the same understanding I do of how cancer cells metabolize. So making any blanket statement about a cell or an organism is near impossible in biology. You know, there are always exceptions to the rule. So we have to look at generalities, and then we have to focus in on particular groups of people. And test these hypotheses. So the difference I can say, if we compare our approach, which is a high fat, high saturated fat, low carbohydrate diet, to what's now recommended by our policymakers, which is a high carbohydrate, extremely low fat, extremely low saturated fat diet, I will ask your 800 or so viewers, you know, somebody out there, tell me what it is about a saturated fat at the cellular molecular level that causes problems, because nobody in 10 years has ever said what it is. It's all epidemiological correlational studies.
Right.
However, exactly. If you look at what a low carb diet does at the cellular molecular level in diabetes, cancer, cardiovascular disease, we can tell you at the cellular molecular level what that diet is doing to improve your outcomes. So if we want to get a bit geeky for a while, you know, the ketone that's produced, it's actually a ketone body, the beta hydroxybutyrate, which is something of a super molecule, actually does at least 3 or 4 different things on its own. This is a great slide that I have in my presentation. Ryan Parkinson did this at the Ohio State University. And it shows some of the things that the beta hydroxybutyrate does. These are the ketones in the bottom left there. So it reduces inflammation. It increases those natural killer cells, those CD8 cells. It also upregulates something called AMPK, AMP kinase, which is the molecule that probably delivers most of the benefits from exercise. Perhaps really important is it downregulates something called mTOR, the mammalian target of rapamycin, which is this whole black box of growth promoters. So it lowers the growth rate in about 200 different pathways. And it does something else called HDAC inhibition, which is histone deacetylase, which allows the genes to be activated that correct and shut down the oncogenes that get turned on in cancer cells. So we know at least 4 or 5 absolutely conclusive pathways by which the ketone itself should help, in addition to lowering the glucose, in addition to lowering the insulin levels, and in addition to reducing the burden of what we call AGEs, or advanced glycated entities, which happen when you have too much sugar in your diet, and they start glomming onto chromosomes and proteins and gooping up your arteries and causing the inflammation that leads to cardiovascular disease. So again, we're talking about this in terms of cancer, reducing fatty tissue. We know that obesity is one of the biggest comorbidities associated with cancer. The increase in fatty acid oxidation we talked about. So you're burning fats, which also helps, of course, to reduce adiposity or obesity. You're decreasing the glucose levels, and there's a list of about 8 different things that you benefit from by there. And then you're increasing the level of these beneficial ketone bodies in your system. So somebody show me something like that that tells me how saturated fats cause heart disease, and I'll start to listen, because I've looked for it for more than 10 years. And I'll tell you, I'll save you the time. It doesn't exist, because there is no direct cellular molecular relationship between saturated fats and cardiovascular disease.
Absolutely. And so in this one chart alone, you show multiple mechanistic ways that a ketogenic diet is either going to prevent cancer or is going to decrease the growth of cancer. These are mechanistically known things that we have research to back this up. So let's compare beta hydroxybutyrate, which is one of the ketones your body produces when you eat a ketogenic diet. Let's compare that to fiber, because the average doctor will say, oh, if you want to prevent cancer, you need to increase the fiber in your diet. Do we know the mechanism by which eating fiber decreases the risk of cancer like we know about ketones?
Well, there might be two moderate ways in which it would help. I don't think fiber is necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I know there's people out there that, you know, it's fine. You know, there's soluble and insoluble fiber. The insoluble provides bulk in your feces. It doesn't really do anything metabolically. The soluble fiber is interesting because it may have some benefits. One is it slows the rate at which glucose is absorbed from your digestive system, which means you're going to not peak at the same high levels and you're not going to release as much insulin. So that would have a benefit. Secondly, soluble fiber, when it gets into your colon, it's digested by bacteria there, but it's not turned into glucose. It's turned into short chain fatty acids. Yes. And when those short chain fatty acids get into the colonocytes, the colon cells, they convert those into what? Ketones.
Yeah. And I'm so, not sure from my reading if those fatty acids are actually used systemically or if they're just used by the cuboidal epithelial cells in the colon lining. I'm not sure. You may know the answer to that, but I'm not sure. Another thing that when I'm always watching videos, I'm always reading articles, I'm always looking for new research, and something you hear just constantly is eat the following 5 fruits to prevent cancer. Avoid, you know, obviously bacon and eggs to prevent cancer. But have you seen any mechanistic studies showing that fruit or this particular fruit or this particular berry? Do we have mechanistic research like we're showing on the screen right now for ketones? Is there any mechanistic research showing that some magic molecule in some fruit or some berry can prevent cancer or slow down the growth of cancer? Have you seen anything like that in your studies?
Short answer is no. There are some beneficial chemicals in, you know, plants, and you know, you can absorb it and use those. There are also phytochemicals, which are found only in plants, some of which seem to have, you know, lycopene and so on, have some benefits. So they're not, certainly not bad things. But when we talk about fruit, you know, and they usually say, eat your fruits and vegetables. So right. I would say, you know, Dr. Eric Westman says, you know, I don't eat fruit. I eat berries, and berries have a high concentration of some phytochemicals, and I'll eat, you know, a very small handful of berries in the morning, something like that. In the morning, you're a little more insulin sensitive, and but there's nothing that you need in there. But is there some benefit? Yeah. Is that benefit been shown to reduce the incidence or treat cancer? Not that I've seen. No,
I agree. Sama says, should glioblastoma patient be eating high sugar carb diet, and will eating a keto carnivore diet help?
Glioblastoma multiforme, or GBM. These are very serious brain tumors. Yes. In the brain stem, generally fatal almost 100% of the time. And it's really interesting, you know, that when they occur, it'll move up the brainstem. So You know, if you're very young, it tends to be very low in the medulla oblongata, and then it moves up in the midbrain and up into the cerebral hemispheres, but it tends to be in the brainstem area. They're generally untreatable because they're in the brain, so you can't use surgery. Radiation is the only really effective treatment. Now, there have been some studies, and Dom D'Agostino is the person to talk to about this, where they've used a combination of hyperbaric oxygen therapy as well as a ketogenic diet to reduce the tumors. And there are some amazing examples of people that have been tumor-free for 5 or 10 years. And that, you know, almost 100% of people with GBMs, it's fatal within a year. It's a very serious form.
Yes, absolutely.
So this is actually one of the most exciting areas of using ketogenic diets as a therapeutic. It seems to be very effective, but it has to be really quite extreme. You know, you really have to get those carbs down to near zero.
Almost and, like a ketogenic diet for a seizure disorder. It has to be super, super high fat, almost as close to zero carb as you can possibly get.
Yeah.
S-Gillian, this tugs at my heart right here, but it also shows you that hope. My dad, my mom, my brother all died from chemo or from cancer. I asked oncologists what diet changes we should make. He said none and pushed Ensure. Which is basically a sugar-filled melted milkshake. That's what that is. And many doctors recommend Ensure. I think that's malpractice. When a doctor recommends Ensure, we'll see how the courts decide on that later. But S. Jillian's lost 90 pounds on keto with the goal of avoiding cancer. I want everybody watching this. If you've lost a family member to cancer, tell me who in the comments. Mom, dad, granddad, grandmother, brother, sister, put it in the comments. I know, Doc, you lost somebody. Tell us about that and then speak to Jillian.
Well, my mother, I grew up with a mother who had breast cancer back in the 1960s. And, you know, that was when the treatments were pretty horrific. She was actually one of the first people to be involved with the cobalt bomb treatment, which was the first radiation treatments at Montreal General Hospital. Struggled with it for 5 years and finally passed away in her early 40s. So it was probably, I don't know if we knew how to diagnose in those days, a triple negative, you know, very aggressive early stage breast cancer. So that gives me, you know, some incentive to try and figure this out. I certainly wouldn't do this if I didn't think there was, you know, pretty darn sure it was going to be helpful. And I have to say, you know, working with Dr. Volek's team at the Ohio State University, they're throwing everything at this. They have the best imaging people in the world. They're using a digital PET scan in a clinical study for the first time ever. They have a commercial kitchen where we produce and weigh all of the foods that the patients eat, so we know exactly what they're eating to a tenth of a gram. We're doing blood draws. We're doing ketones every day, but blood draws every few weeks so that we know exactly what's happening. We get samples at the BC Cancer Research Center, and we do the immunohistochemistry, so we know exactly what cells are activated or upregulated, as we say, or downregulated. And we can relate that to what we know about how those cells behave as anti-cancer cells. So we're throwing everything we can at it, all the technology we can. It is really a pretty small study. It's a pilot study. So, you know, we can't draw broad conclusions. And the women that we can recruit, that we're allowed to recruit due to the research ethics, are very, very sick women. They're going to, you know, they have a life expectancy of 6 months to a year typically. So they're very brave women that are volunteering to do this. And I have to say, you know, the outcome, I can't talk about the full results yet until it's published.
Sure.
But certainly very positive indications that as an adjunct therapy, it has effect for these women with breast cancer. We have seen the kinds of cellular molecular changes that we expected to see. The other thing to perhaps, you know, first do no harm as a physician yourself is no bad outcomes. There was no women dropped out of the trials because of any problems with the diet. So what we saw was, even though these women were very sick and effectively dying, they responded the same way normal healthy people would respond to a ketogenic diet. They lost the body fat, they had improvements in blood sugar and blood lipids and so on, just like anybody else would. So we know it's not going to cause any harm. And what we're trying to do is estimate the benefit. Now, that's treating a cancer that's very, very progressed. If we're looking at, again, you know, people ask me because I work in cancer research, what's the best treatment? The best treatment is don't get it in the first place.
100%. And do you think Jillian's strategy of losing 90 pounds and eating a ketogenic diet, is that a rational strategy to decrease her risk of cancer.
Absolutely. No, it's not just rational. It's I congratulate her more first for losing 90 pounds.
Yeah.
That's a challenge. I mean, there are a lot of people that are very plus size people that are struggling with this. And I can tell you, ketogenic diet is the best way, you know, full stop, to naturally lose that weight, you know, without surgeries and without drugs or anything like that. So that's great. And if you're reducing that adiposity burden, the cellular molecular activities that are causing you to lose that weight are also very positive in terms of preventing you from getting cancer. And
absolutely,
you know, as someone whose parent died of cancer, yeah, I don't want to get it either. So far, you know, touch wood, so good, so far, so good. And so I think, yeah, she's absolutely doing the right thing.
Yep. And based on the chart that we showed earlier, let's talk about hyperinsulinemia now, because mm-hmm. I've heard you talk about that before, and I think you and I agree on this completely. Of course, when you eat a diet that's high in sugar, in starches, in any kind of carbohydrates, it's going to spike your blood sugar, but then your pancreas is immediately going to try to pull the blood sugar back down to normal by spiking your insulin. And so if people are eating a high carb diet every day with snacks in between, they're going to have something that I've started calling hyperinsulinemia. And some people speak about this as insulin resistance, which I think may be kind of an upside down and backwards way of thinking about it, because you can actually measure serum insulin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But you can't really measure insulin resistant directly. And so everything on this chart is affected by not only high blood sugar, but also by hyperinsulinemia, chronically elevated levels of insulin. So make this a global statement of how changing your diet is going to decrease your risk of having all these things.
Yeah. So I don't know if you have it available, but I have this model. It's on one of my slides called the axis of illness. And if you
think
look,
I have that one, doctor.
Yeah. I may have linked you to the wrong slide deck, but that's okay. You picture a triangle, and on that triangle, you have insulin resistance at the top. You have obesity on one of the bottom sides, and you have inflammation on the other. And I think you talk to any clinician or any physician, and they'll tell you, boy, if you can do something for those three things, reduce obesity, which is a disease, reduce insulin resistance, reduce inflammation, each of those independently is responsible for about 70% of chronic disease. So collectively, there's a tremendous power if you can find one way to treat all those things at the same time. And this is what a ketogenic diet does, because it reduces all of those things. So when you talked about hyperinsulinemia, which is the correct term, which means your chronically excessive levels of insulin in the blood, what causes that? It's caused by chronically ingesting too much carbohydrate and stimulating the release of that insulin. So that's caused absolutely by a high carb diet. A high carb diet will also lead to obesity. It just will. It's your body's way of getting rid of that excess glucose and storing it. And if your insulin levels are even slightly elevated, it really biases that towards storing as fat rather than burning in the cells. So you put inflammation in there as well. Cardiovascular disease is not caused by cholesterol or, you know, high fat diet. It's caused by inflammation in the blood vessels. And all of those three elements, I call them the axis of illness. So we have insulin resistance, we have obesity, we have inflammation. They all make each other worse. And so it doesn't matter which comes first. Once you get one started, the other two will keep going, and it'll just keep getting worse until you change your lifestyle. And eventually it wears your body down. So you can't just keep secreting too much insulin forever. Those beta cells in your pancreas that release them get tired. And all of a sudden, we don't have any insulin left, you know? So then what do you have to do? You have to start taking units of insulin every day just to get your blood sugar down. What's that going to do? It's going to make the disease even worse, right? Because you're adding insulin to people who have glucose tolerance issues. So those three things are all related. And as we talked about earlier, they're all manifestations of metabolic disorder.
Yes.
So your cells are not metabolizing the way they want to because you're giving them the wrong fuel. It's like putting crappy gasoline into your car. If you want to switch to the high octane stuff, That's kind of what ketones are. And one of the interesting things we've shown in our studies is when we do the imaging of the women before and after being on a ketogenic diet, initially their heart glows, not because they have cancer, because that heart cells love fuel and they'll just, because it keeps going all the time. It's a very anaerobic organ and it'll just sop up all the glucose it can. But when we put them on a ketogenic diet, the heart disappears. Why? Well, it's the glucose there doesn't need it anymore.
Right.
Why is that? Well, because it prefers ketones and fatty acids because they have less stress burden at the cellular level, what we call reactive oxygen species and oxidative stress. So that's that inflammation side of it too, right?
And so, I think that's so important that people understand that. Everybody listen to this carefully. The muscle cells that make up your heart actually prefer to run on ketones. And we see this in the before and after pictures. If you go and watch some of Dr. Harper's other videos, he actually has motion videos of the PET scans before and after. And you can see the heart in the initial study, when it's a glucose burner, lights up very dark. But then at the end of the study, now that they're keto adapted, right, that heart's burning ketones. It would rather have ketones rather than glucose. But if you're eating a high carb diet, you're not giving it that option. So this goes directly to Tedros's question. You said earlier that if you eat too many carbs, you're going to get fat. And that's very true for some subsets of the population whose genetics are like mine and like yours. 100% we'll get fat. But there are many people in the world, people in Ethiopia, in India, in the Asian countries, who it's very hard for them to become obese or severely obese, but they can become disastrously hyperinsulinemic. Mm-hmm. And so for somebody like Tedros's mom, Tedros, probably what's happening is when your mother goes to the doctor, your doc's checking a basic metabolic panel, which checks a fasting blood sugar. Your doctor's probably not checking an A1C, a hemoglobin A1C. And therefore, if your mom fasts for 12 hours before blood work, her blood sugar can be normal. Her fasting glucose can be normal, and she might be severely pre-diabetic or type 2 diabetic. And without an A1C, your doctor's blind to that. And she doesn't fatten easily because of her genetic predisposition. Therefore, she looks healthy. Now, even an additional layer to that is most doctors never check a fasting insulin level or a C-peptide. And so your mother could have a normal blood sugar and a normal A1C, but be dangerously hyperinsulinemic. And if your doctor doesn't check a C-peptide and or a fasting insulin, then your doctor's blind to that. And so she gets sent home saying, oh, you're healthy as a horse. You're doing good. Keep doing what you're doing. All the while she's suffering from severe metabolic disease. And I see this all the time. And in many countries, it's almost impossible to get a doctor to order a fasting insulin test. And that's a personal pet peeve of mine as a healthcare provider and practitioner. Let's talk about what's wrong with doctors, Dr. Harper. What the hell is wrong with the average doctor who's recommending Ensure to their obese patients or to their patients who've been diagnosed with cancer, who are saying, here, you've had your chemo treatment. Now here's some orange juice and some cookies. What the hell is going on in these doctors' minds? Do they magically believe that the human diet somehow is just magically does not matter? Or do they just not give a damn? Or are they so nutritionally ignorant that they don't even realize that the shit that they're promoting to their patients is actually promoting metabolic disease? Time to bring it, Dr. Harper. Let's hear it. What's your opinion?
Well, you know, I have good friends that are physicians, yourself included. I don't want to paint them all with the same brush. I think it's our system. Again, it's a disease management system, so it's easy to provide a pill. You know, so I think there's a lot of, Americans, a lot of people in the West, Canadians, whatever, that are obese and they just want to keep eating what they're eating. And they want the pharmacy industry to come up with a pill that's going to prevent them from getting obese or getting sick. That's not the right way to go about it. I think that they don't get any nutrition education in the first place. Secondly, is I don't think they are necessarily up to speed on the research because, you know, there's a million publications a year, 3,000 a day in health science. It's hard to keep up with all that stuff. So, you know, why aren't they listening to what's happening? It takes about 17 years for a scientific discovery to get into basic clinical practice in a physician's office. Again, ask yourself, do I have 17 years to wait for this to happen?
Right.
What I'm finding is just what you were finding too, is now the physicians are sort of getting that information from their patients. They're going, hey, wow, you've lost a lot of weight. That's great. Look, your blood sugar is great. Your blood lipids are great. What have you been doing? Well, I went on this keto diet. And they go, oh, okay. Because what you probably learned was ketoacidosis, right? High ketones is from late stage diabetes and it can kill you. So they hear the word keto and they think it's dangerous. Well, it's not. It's natural. And you have that proper human diet. I have that natural human diet. Babies are in ketosis in the womb. They're born in ketosis and they stay in ketosis as long as they're breastfeeding. This is the natural proper human state, is a state of nutritional ketosis. And so when you put your body into that state, it prevents you from having a metabolic disorder that will manifest as a disease. So you don't even end up in the physician's office in the first place. That's the best thing. Now, absolutely. Can we re-educate them? That's what we really have to do. That's why your show and others like it are so important, because, I am part of an organization called the Canadian Clinicians for Therapeutic Nutrition. I think there's 8,000 now, mostly physicians. They're saying, hey, wait a minute. We never really learned any nutrition. Now that we looked at it, maybe we have this whole thing wrong. And the other part of that wrong thing, Dr. Barry, is getting someone to admit they were wrong. Especially if they've been telling people to do something for 20 or 30 years and go, you know what, all that low fat stuff I told you, I got to apologize. So those who read my book, Bio Diet, that's one of the first things I do. I said, I taught the wrong stuff for 30 years before I realized what I didn't do as a scientist. I didn't go back and look for the primary research that tied high fat diets to disease. And when I did, I didn't find it because it doesn't exist.
Right.
There was one guy in his gang, Ansel Keys, that tried to drive that hypothesis forward, and they drove it into the American Cardiology Society, and they drove it into the dietitians, and we have this model, which is really just a hypothesis that a low-fat, high-carb diet is a healthy diet. And as I say in my book, we didn't experiment on the Western world for about 30 years telling him to eat that. And look at the data yourself. What happened since the first guidelines for nutrition came out in 1980? Skyrocketing rates of diabetes, skyrocketing rates of obesity, skyrocketing rates of inflammatory related diseases, which is why you measure that C-reactive protein. So that's association, sure it is, but we can also tell you on the cellular molecular level that eating all those high sugar, high processed foods is going to make you sick. And if you're eating those, you have to stop and you have to learn to eat and enjoy a proper human diet, a natural human diet, which is high fat, high omega-3, grass-fed butter, eat your meat, eat the skin, eat the fat. You have to start doing that. And when you do, I can tell you two things. It will do no harm, but there is a transition period. So you should discuss it with a physician because, as you know, Dr. Barry, there's often a need for concomitant reduction in antihypertensive and antihyperglycemic drugs. Absolutely. So you need to talk to your physician before you start. But once you do it for 12 weeks and see what happens. And I would be shocked if you didn't go, oh my God, I've been rejuvenated. That's why I call one of the stages rejuvenation, right? You just do this for 12 weeks and you go, I don't hurt anymore. I've lost all this body fat. My brain is cleared up. I seem to be more cognitively functional. And if it doesn't work, which happens, for about 1 out of 8 people, it doesn't work, then carry on with whatever you were doing before. But don't eat the crappy food that they're trying to sell you that tastes good and you can't stop eating it and then hope that the medical system is going to be able to fix you. What you need to do is get that stuff out of your diet, eat a proper human diet, and then you can move on to a happy, healthy life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've got a ton of comments and questions. We got 1,700 watching now. Thank you guys for sharing this video and helping reach more people. Let me see if I can find a question here.
What was the question earlier, Dr. Barry, about Asians and higher carbohydrates?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So two of the things I would encourage you to look at is what's the average life expectancy in those countries? Most chronic diseases don't really start to affect you until your 50s and later, and often that's the average lifespan. So when in North America, before World War II, the average lifespan was only in the 50s. And it was only, since then that we've been able to live long enough to experience those chronic diseases. The other thing, if you look at, you know, Asians, if you look at South Asians in India, huge rates of obesity and heart disease in males in India for sure. And then a lot of them, yes, it's a high carb diet, but it's also you're malnourished. It's really, really hard to get full nutrition, which is what we call a balanced diet. It's really hard to do that if you're not going to eat meat and a lot more fat. You need about 40% of your calories from fat just for your brain to be happy.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I think there's a bit of a misnomer that, you know, yep, Asians eat a lot of rice. They eat rice at the end of the meal if they're still hungry, right?
Yeah.
And it's only a small amount. I guess the other question was, can people adapt to be sort of more resistant to carbs? Well, you can actually test for that genetically. And some people do metabolize carbs better than others and probably are more resistant to type 2 diabetes. But if you look at, let's look at America, 78% of American adults over 18 are now overweight or obese. That is the definition or one of the definitions or one of the key elements of metabolic disease. So you have three quarters of Americans have metabolic disease.
Yep. And I'm working more and more with doctors from India now. And it's very common there because the average Indian eats a very high carbohydrate diet, but they're almost uniformly slender. They might have a little belly pooch, but they're not obese like people in America get. And so the argument is this guy's slender. He's healthy. He doesn't have any markers of disease. And then when I talk to the Indian doctors, they're like, yeah, no doctor here checks fasting insulin.
Yeah.
Right. And many of them don't even check an A1C. And so they see the normal blood sugar because the person fasted for 12, 14, 16 hours. And they're like, there you go. You don't have diabetes. But if they, first of all, checked the hemoglobin A1C, they would see that they have absolutely verifiable prediabetes or type 2 diabetes, in many cases, severe type 2 diabetes.
And if they do, we call it TOFI, thin outside, fat inside. So absolutely. Just because you're lean outside doesn't mean we're talking about the visceral fat that impacts on the organs and so on that you can't see inside. That's the fat that's important, not the little roll of your belly or your bum or whatever. It's the internal stuff. And you can be very thin, but still fat inside. And those people that are thin outside, but have type 2 diabetes, they have very poor outcomes because I actually think that obesity is your body's way of trying not to raise your blood. It's getting that sugar out of your blood and putting it somewhere. It has to go somewhere. So it goes into fat. Those that can't do that to address the adaptability or the metabolic differences, people, those that can't do that, that blood sugar just stays high and the insulin stays high. So they often have worse outcomes.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. We actually talk about it as a protective mechanism. People who are able to fatten very often will be very, very fat. I used to be 297 pounds at my fattest, and I was only pre-diabetic, whereas other people with different genetic diversity, perhaps different gut microbiomes, they wouldn't have got very fat, but they would have been severely type 2. Diabetes. And so now looking back now, I'm very glad that I was a fat ass because that probably protected me from developing severe uncontrolled type 2 diabetes. Well, and it has a lot to do with your genetic diversity. Doc, if somebody's just joining us right now and they're like, okay, I want you to tell me, Dr. David Harper, PhD, who teaches medical students and teaches residents, I want you to tell me, if you had to just say, okay, here's three steps to fix your diet. Here's the stuff you should eat. Here's the stuff you shouldn't eat. Here, this is it. Go.
Don't eat sugar. Don't eat anything processed. So up and down those aisles, don't eat the stuff in the middle of the grocery store that's in a package. If it's in a package, don't eat it. If it says natural or healthy, probably not. Don't eat that. Don't eat any high glycemic index stuff, sugar, bread, pasta, rice. Don't eat that. Do eat saturated fats. Somebody talked about eggs in here earlier. I eat probably, my wife and I, maybe 3-4 dozen eggs a week. That's why there's an egg on the cover of my book. It's nature's perfect food. And I want to ask you about that a little bit too. So
yeah that's why we bought chicken. We have chickens now in the backyard for that very reason, because eggs are, especially properly raised hens' eggs, unbelievable superfood.
When you think about it, the egg has almost no carbohydrate in it.
That's right.
Almost not. It's almost zero. Yet somehow, without eating anything, that produces the same 200 tissue types, substitute feathers and hair, as we have. So yep. Somehow all the cells know what to do in the complete absence of carbohydrate. And there are no essential carbohydrates. You don't have to eat any at all. Your body can make its own through a process called neogluconeogenesis, or making new glucose, gluconeogenesis, right?
Yes.
So that's the main thing is don't worry about saturated fats. Eat what you like. Eat a diet that you enjoy that includes meat and fish and beef and bacon and just avoid processed foods and avoid sugar and carbohydrate. Just that, and drink more water. Be fine. I would like to ask you, because it's something that I've been meaning to ask you though, Dr. Barry, is there's a lot of people when I talk, they talk, well, what about fasting? So I'd like to hear what your thoughts are on fasting. I have some which I'm willing to share, but I'd like to hear your thoughts first.
Yeah, the research that I have reviewed and the anecdotal evidence that I've gotten from literally tens of thousands of people who comment on our videos and are part of our private community, fasting absolutely speeds up the metabolizing fat, stored fat, and so it helps people lose weight faster. For many people, it helps break what I consider to be a real entity. Some doctors don't think it's real, but sugar addiction, mm-hmm. I think it helps with that. It absolutely increases your rate of both autophagy, which is your body's recycling of old and damaged cells and breaking them down and building new, healthy, vibrant cells out of them. Not only autophagy, but also mitophagy, mm-hmm. doing the same thing with mitochondria. Mitochondria are the powerhouse of the cell, right? And so if you've got an old, crippled, damaged mitochondria, your body's going to tag that when you fast for longer periods of time. And it's going to break that mitochondria down, and it's going to use those constituent parts to build a new, healthy, vibrant mitochondria. Now, there's always some degree of autophagy and mitophagy going on in your body at all times, even if you're eating just a completely shit diet. You still have some known rate of that, but the rate of autophagy and mitophagy increase dramatically the longer that you fast. And so many, many benefits. We've had followers of ours for 5 years now who lost over 200 pounds, David. Mm-hmm. And you would expect them to look like Shar-Pei puppies, right? but they made intermittent fasting a big part of their weight loss journey. Whether it was an 18 or a 20-hour daily intermittent fast, or whether they fasted for 3 days once a week or 5 days once a month, they just made that part of their lifestyle. And now to look at them, you know how some people lose weight and you can look at them and be like, well, they've obviously lost weight, but you can tell they used to be really large just by looking at them. These people look like they were never fat. And this doesn't happen for everybody, but I think it's because of that normal distribution curve that every single thing in human physiology is plotted upon. I think there are some people that fasting like that is just borderline magical in the body recomposition that it can have. Other people, it doesn't seem to have as much effect. Of course, these are not controlled studies, so we're not peeking into their living rooms and seeing if they're actually fasting or not. We're just going from self-reported data. I'd love to hear your thoughts on fasting as well. And then I want to ask you about vegetable seed oils.
Well, no. okay, so let's do the vegetable seed oils. Just go Google vegetable seed oil processing and look at the pictures, and they look like oil refineries because that's what they are. That's the most processed food, and it's horrible. Highly, highly inflammatory. And, you know, nut oils like avocado oil or olive oil, fine. I like grass-fed butter. That's my favorite fat.
Yes.
Seed oils, absolutely no. And especially the really cheap ones like linseed oil and cottonseed oil that they use at those fast food places to fry French fries.
Yeah.
You know,
they don't change the grease, doctor. You know, my dad actually used to be a regional distributor for Kentucky Fried Chicken. He would repair their cookers and he would take them supplies and stuff. Dude, when I was probably 12, 13, I would go in the back of the KFC store And it literally smelled so bad that I would have to go sit out on the stoop in less than safe neighborhoods. And my dad would have to come look out the back door every 10 seconds because he didn't want me to get abducted. But it was awful. Everything was slippery and greasy. But those guys, he would say, you guys are not changing your oil often enough. And you can understand, as a franchise owner, every time you change that oil, it's probably 30 gallons. That's $400.
Yeah.
And so ideally, they're supposed to change it very, very regularly. But any franchise owner is going to be like, well, I'll change it. We'll go another day. It's not too dark. It's not too rancid. We'll go another day. And really, in truth, the only time they change the oil is when customers start to come bring the chicken back and say, this don't taste right. That's when they change the oil. And so not only are you getting vegetable seed oil that's super high in omega-6 fatty acids, but in a fast food restaurant, if you buy anything fried like that, bet me that oil is not being changed according to schedule, because money's tight in this economy. They're not going to change that oil until somebody complains about the taste of the chicken or whatever the fried food is. I personally don't find as much research showing the mechanistic things that we showed for GHB and for hyperglycemia and hyperinsulinemia. I absolutely, one of my three first things is stop all sugar, both added and natural. Stop all grains. And then number three, stop all vegetable seed oils. That's been my first three recommendations for everybody since 2017. But I have to be honest, I don't find as much research supporting the stop all vegetable seed oils as I find with the first two. And I always like to ask people about that. Now, eggs.
Yeah. Well, eggs, nature's perfect food, you know, as we said, you get all the, you know, we're vertebrates like chickens are, and you don't need any. So it just tells you don't need carbohydrates for starters. The cholesterol in the eggs does not relate very strongly to the cholesterol in your blood. If you have cholesterol issues, I mean, we don't want to start an hour into an interview talking about whether LDL is worth measuring or not and what the meaning is. But
let's just suffice it. Let's just sum it up like this. The American Heart Association a few years back came out and said, eating cholesterol in your diet is no longer of any concern. Okay. Yes. They just very recently came out with a new statement that said that saturated fat in your diet is unrelated to these risks.
And the diabetes associations are now recognizing low carb and ketogenic diets as you know, they're saying, you know, that's another option for you. So they are coming around, and the reason they're coming around, these are very conservative, very risk averse organizations, is that the evidence in support of low carb ketogenic diets is overwhelmingly positive. And there is the first, you know, harm, any negative effects are short term, transitional, and mild. So there are some, and I list them in the book in the first part of the second half. There's about, you know, 30 or 40 really rare genetic disorders where you can't metabolize ketones. And for those, the diet would be contraindicated. And you need to discuss that with your physician. It's not something you would know unless you tested for it.
Exactly. I actually did a YouTube video about that. It's probably 20,000 people in the entire United States have a genetic defect where they probably shouldn't do keto or ketovore or carnivore. It's a minuscule amount of people. The vast majority, 99.99% of people around the world, can enjoy all the benefits of a ketogenic diet. Doc, we're at the hour. Any final thoughts, any final advice to anybody out there? Someone's like, okay, I get it. I hear you guys, but my doctor said I should eat a plant-based diet, lots of whole grains, lots of fruit juice smoothies. Talk to that person, Dr. Harper. Tell them what you think.
Well, I have to sort of, you know, empathize with the physician, because they have decision trees. And you probably talked about this, is when you have certain systems, they go through their decision trees. If the patient says yes, then this is what you prescribe. If they say no, then you go down this. And so they're, you know, if they recommend what the American dietitians organizations say is the recommend, or what the government says, they reduce their liability to zero because they're recommending what's being told. So physicians like yourself, who have more courage in reality, are saying, actually, we should question that. You actually assume some liability if you get it wrong. Yes. And if you had got that wrong, you've been doing this a long time, you'd be in jail right now. And you know, I think it's going to go to jail, the processed food people, because I think they know that this food, this high sugar, high processed, high carb food is killing people.
Absolutely.
If you look at diabetes alone, and the burden of treating just type 2 diabetes, which is 90% of diabetes in the United States, and you take the rate of increase of diabetes to where they project it for 2030, the United States alone, people will be spending $660 billion a year just to treat type 2 diabetes. And if you compare that, to put it in context, right now, the U.S. defense budget is about $660 billion a year. So that's what we're spending to treat a disease which is largely preventable and can be reversed. With, think of the savings for governments that could then go into schools and hospitals and maybe better nutrition educating for physicians in Absolutely. Medical school. So I guess the news is there is good news.
Here we have an
option. Do discuss it with your physician. It's not a cure for cancer, if we want to talk about that, but I think it's the most important lifestyle decision that will help prevent you from getting one of these chronic diseases. We didn't even get into Alzheimer's disease because the brain loves ketones too. But
absolutely. We'll do that another hour, another day.
Yeah.
Dr. David Harper, author of The Bio Diet. I have a copy of this. It's available on Amazon and at all bookstores. I've got a link down in the show notes.
Great.
If you want to get a copy, there is an Audible version.
Audible. And we read it ourselves. My wife and I as a co-author.
I love it.
And there's an ebook. I always tell people, you know, it's not an expensive book, and they should buy your book too. Lies My Doctor Told Me. I'm sure they already have yours, but I would say buy two, one for you and one to give to your physician when they start.
100%, absolutely. And you know, many of my patients or followers have done that, and I thought back in 2017 when I was contemplating doing this, I initially wanted to work at the upper level. I wanted to try to change government guidelines, change the ADA, change the AHA. But very similar to you, at some point I realized that's a fool's errand.
Yep.
That's going to take 17 years, 20 years, 25 years. How many grandmothers are going to die between now and then? How many children are we going to lose to metabolic disease, to cancer and others during that time? And I said, you know, no, I'm going to go to the people. I'm just going to go to the people. I'm going to tell them what I've learned, both from my personal experience, from the research, from the common sense, from the archaeology, from the paleoanthropology. I'm going to put it all together and just present it to the people and let them say, huh, that's cool. I think I'll try that. Or no, I'm just going to follow my doctor's advice. But either way, at least they had a choice and they didn't have to wait 20 damn years to have the choice. Mm-hmm. And so I applaud you, Dr. David Harper, for also going to the people. I know you speak at conferences all the time. I think you're doing tremendous work. I love your book. I hope there's a second one on the way. Thank you so much for joining us. Any final words, my friend?
Well, we'll have to write that second book together then.
Hey, that's good. Text me. I'll just tell you, full disclosure, I am a terrible literary partner. Okay. I have terrible ADHD and you will have to goad me and prod me constantly. But when you do get me in gear, I turn out fairly decent work.
Yeah. We'll go and talk about that next time. We're speaking together like we did back in April in Salt Lake City. It was a pleasure to meet you in person and a pleasure to meet you online and to have an opportunity to talk to the good folks that tune into your show. And for those folks, I absolutely applaud Dr. Barry for what he's doing. It is the right way. We're not going to convince policymakers and large bodies, advisory bodies, quickly enough to affect your individual health. So make sure you get good sources. There's all kinds of crap out there on the internet as well. That's why I wrote the book. That's why I'm trying to get the right information so that you, and it's I think a pretty engageable, easily to understand. It's not like deep science stuff.
That's I totally agree. Yes, there. Yeah. Absolutely.
So you'll have the information that will inform you. And when you make those informed decisions, you'll realize not only is this the right thing to do, but after about 12 weeks, you're going to go, that's the best decision I ever made in my life. Maybe post getting married or having children.
Absolutely. Dr. Harper, thank you so much for this. It was a pleasure. I'll see you next time.
Great.
All right. Bye-bye.